Coming up on this episode of Crime Family.
I'm a meter reader with Orange County, and I had the route today that included the Anthony home. In an area, I noticed something that looked white, and there was, I don't know what it is. I'm not telling you it's, you know, scary or anything of that nature.
She goes and gets a tattoo on her back that says, quote, Bella Vita, which translates to the good life. So it's interesting that only weeks after your daughter goes missing, which you haven't yet reported, by the way, you go and get a tattoo that says the good life. There's a MySpace blog that's written by someone in the Anthony home that reads, quote, my Kaylee is missing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree. Like, where's the line of, oh, there's three circumstantial things. That's not enough, but four is enough. Or maybe it just depends on the quality of the circumstances.
I mean, this is like, people might hate me for this, so don't come at me. Maybe I'm totally wrong and it is true, but.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Crime Family. I'm your host, AJ, and I'm here with my two sisters, Stephanie and Katie. And this week is part two of our Kaylee Anthony murder case and the trial of Casey Anthony overview. So if you didn't listen to part one, go check that out now. We kind of set the groundwork for what the initial investigation looked like and catching Casey in a lot of lies and sort of how it all began. And then in this part, we're going to go into a little bit more detail about some of the timeline of the 31 days. If you're familiar with this case or if you listen to part one, you'll know that there was that 31-day time frame between when Kaylee went missing and when she was reported. So we're going to go into a little bit of that timeline here in this episode and also a little bit more about the unfortunate grisly discovery at the end of 2008 that kind of changes everything in this case. So we're going to go into that as well. So thanks so much for joining us, and we're going to get right into part two. So Detective Eric Matthews interviews Casey's dad, George Anthony, and he claims that the last time that he saw Casey and Kaylee together was on June 16th of 2008. So he says that he saw them as Casey was leaving her father's home on her way to drop Kaylee off at Zanny the Nanny's house. And you'll remember that name from part one. So June 16th also coincides with the date that Casey says she last saw Kaylee as well. And it was this day that she says, or she told police, that she dropped Kaylee off at Zanny's to go to work. And then she found Zanny and Kaylee both gone upon her return to Zanny's apartment later that day. So June 16th is therefore day one of this 31-day timeline leading up to that July 15th 911 call that Cindy makes to authorities. So Eric Matthews begins a thorough investigation of Casey's calendar, online activities, and begins to piece together a timeline of events during those 31 days that paints a very negative image of Casey. And it's a far cry from a panicked mother that's frantically searching for her daughter. Instead, she becomes much more socially active after June 16th, and photos show her out partying with friends. So on the evening of June 16th, the same day that George Anthony claims was the last time he saw Kaylee, when she left with Casey from his house, Casey is seen on surveillance footage with her then-boyfriend, Tony Lazzaro, at a Blockbuster video store. And Kaylee is not seen on this surveillance footage. I didn't even know Blockbuster was still around in 2008, but I guess you learn something every day. On June 18th, a neighbor of the Anthonys claims that Casey came over to borrow a shovel in order to help dig out some bamboo root in the family's backyard. Then on June 20th, Casey is photographed dancing at the nightclub Fusion. And I think this is from, this is the night that a lot of those photos were taken that you'll see. In the coverage of this case, you'll see a lot of the same photos come up of her dancing, her doing like a hot body contest or something at one of these bars. I believe that's on June 20th. So keep in mind, this is 4 days after she says that she was doing her own independent investigation into where Kaylee is, but she's out drinking and dancing at nightclubs. On June 23rd, Tony Lazzaro, Casey's boyfriend, claims that Casey called him to say that she had run out of gas. And he says that he eventually helped her break into Cindy and George Anthony's shed in order to get some gas cans so that she could fill up the car herself. So I don't really know the details of why she needed to break into the garage to get her own gas, like why she couldn't just go to a gas station or any of that. But that is something that has been corroborated, and he says that he helped her break into the shed. And I do believe, I don't have it here in my notes, but I do believe that this resulted in an argument between Casey and her father the next day on June 24th about the missing gas cans. Because he noticed that they were gone from the shed, and she told him that she had broken in and stolen them. Or he maybe came and saw that the shed had been broken into and then noticed the gas cans missing, and she admits that it was her. On June 27th, cell records show that Casey texted her friend Amy Huizenga that morning to say that, quote, "There is definitely part of an animal plastered to the frame of my car," end quote. So she also runs out of gas again on this day, but this time she leaves the car, which was a white Pontiac Sunfire, in an Amcot parking lot. And this is where it stays for several days until it's eventually towed to the impound garage. The owner of Amcot, I guess, or the manager there, sees the car. It's been parked near a dumpster in the parking lot close to them, and he eventually just has it towed. He doesn't know who it belongs to or why it's there, but they tow it to the impound garage, which is where George then later goes to retrieve it, which we mentioned in the last part. So he doesn't go until July to retrieve the car on July 15th. So June 27th is when she leaves the car in the Amcot parking lot, and then July 15th is where George goes to get it. So there's a couple of weeks in there that it's been parked at Amcot, and then probably a bit of time before when it's towed, and then George and Cindy are notified of it. So then the evening of June 30th, Casey is seen on surveillance footage at JCPenney's. She uses her mother's stolen credit card to purchase $73 worth of items, and Kaylee is not seen on this surveillance footage either. On July 2nd or 3rd, I don't know which day it is because I've seen reports that say both. So some say July 2nd, some say July 3rd. So I'll just say either one of those days. She goes and gets a tattoo on her back that says, quote, "Bella Vita," which translates to the good life. So it's interesting that only weeks after your daughter goes missing, which you haven't yet reported, by the way, you go and get a tattoo that says the good life. That's a very weird thing to get tattooed, considering everything in your life is not going good if your daughter is missing. So just very weird. The tattoo shop owner claims that Casey's demeanor that day in the tattoo shop was normal, as it always was. He says that she had been in the tattoo shop many times before with Kaylee. So when she showed up without her, the first thing that he asked Casey was, you know, "Where's Kaylee?" And he says that without hesitation, she said that she was with the nanny. So this nanny is someone that many of her friends, her family, and her acquaintances knew of. She mentioned her a lot. Everyone knew that Kaylee had a nanny, even if they didn't know her name. But we now know that she didn't have a nanny, and her name wasn't Zanny the nanny, and all of that stuff. So I know the tattoo is like one of the major things in this case that's really pointed to that doesn't look good for Casey. Like, what are your guys' thoughts about her getting that tattoo, or just about the circumstances surrounding that?
I mean, it's definitely sketchy because, of course, we know now that she wasn't with the nanny and that her daughter actually is missing. And, of course, many people think that she's the one that killed her. So even if she's just missing, why isn't she more worried about it? Why is she out partying, getting a tattoo? If she's the one that did kill her, like, it just shows that she really does not care. But also, someone brought this up before, like, if she didn't kill her, she's not the murderer, and she's just missing, then just because she doesn't care about where her kid is doesn't mean she's a murderer, right? So, I mean, it doesn't look good, but that doesn't mean she killed her.
Yeah, I think the whole tattoo thing is just a coincidence. I don't know if it has anything to do with her daughter being missing, but also what Katie said, like, that what she does and, like, how she reacts doesn't mean she doesn't care that her daughter's missing. I mean,
well, I mean, I think it does. I mean, she's out partying at a nightclub. I mean, which mother who's doing her own investigation?
Yeah, I think it means she doesn't care, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she murdered her, right?
Yeah, that's like, I mean, yeah, sorry. Like, yeah, like, I mean, obviously she doesn't care. But I mean, like what Katie said, like, we can't say that she murdered her daughter because we don't know that for a fact. Or do we? I don't know. We don't really know that. So the whole tattoo thing and her partying, I think it's just a coincidence. I don't really think there's anything really behind it.
It by itself doesn't prove anything, but it, like with everything else that we're going to talk about, just makes it look like, yeah, she doesn't give a shit at all about what she did or what has happened.
Yeah. And it's totally incongruent with everything she's saying about herself, that she was going through her own resources to find her. But I don't really think you're going to find her in a nightclub dancing and doing a hot body contest. You're not going to find her there. So I don't know. It paints a completely different picture. So yeah, obviously it doesn't prove. It proves neglect, which is what currently she's charged with and she's in jail with at this time in the investigation. She's in jail for child neglect, which is obvious that she neglected her, but doesn't prove murder, which is true. So also on July 3rd, so this is the same day or around the same time that Casey got that tattoo, there's a MySpace blog that's written by someone in the Anthony home, which is later determined to be Cindy, that reads, quote, 7308, my Kaylee is missing. My Kaylee is missing. Current mood, distraught. She came into my life unexpectedly, just as she has left me. This precious little angel from above gave me strength and unconditional love. Now she is gone, and I don't know why. All I am guilty of is loving her and providing her a safe home. Jealousy has taken her away. Jealousy from the one person that should be thankful for all of the love and support given to her. A mother's love is deep. However, there are limits when one is betrayed by the one she loved and trusted the most. A daughter comes to her mother for support when she is pregnant. The mother says without hesitation it will be okay. And it was. But then the lies and betrayal began. First it seemed harmless. Love is blind. A mother will look for the good in her child and give them a chance to change. This mother gave chance after chance for her daughter to change, but instead more lies, more betrayal. What does the mother get for giving her daughter all of these chances? A broken heart. End quote. So this is what Cindy is writing on MySpace. So at this point, Cindy and George have not seen Kaylee for a few weeks. And Cindy has continually asked Casey where Kaylee is, and Casey always has an excuse. So either she's with Zanny or she's with Jennifer, who was, she said, was Zanny's roommate. So she always has a reason and an excuse for kind of everything. So every time her mother comes and asks her, like, where is she? I haven't seen her in a while. There's always a reasonable explanation. So while Cindy is, of course, concerned and she's irritated, she didn't have any reason to believe that Kaylee was necessarily in danger. But she probably thought it was odd that she would see Casey many times, but never Kaylee. So she claims that she made this MySpace post out of desperation and anger, and that the term, quote, Kaylee is missing, was more so a figure of speech to kind of relay the fact that Kaylee was missing to her and that she hadn't seen her for weeks because Casey was keeping Kaylee from them. And then there's also a Reuters report that says, quote, at various times, Casey claimed that Kaylee was being watched by a series of babysitters, that Kaylee had gone to a business meeting with Casey at Busch Gardens theme park in Tampa, that Kaylee had gone with her to Jacksonville, and that Kaylee was at the beach and at a cartoon character breakfast at Universal. So all these excuses, and there was always, so Cindy and George have not spoken to Kaylee like on the phone. Every time they ask Casey to put Kaylee on, she always says, oh, she's not with me, or she's sleeping, or all that stuff. So they're obviously suspicious, but they don't necessarily think that Casey has like done anything to her at this time. So during the same time frame, Casey steals a checkbook from a friend, Amy Huizinga, and begins writing checks from this checkbook, which Amy eventually presses charges for. So between July 8th and 10th, Casey is captured on various surveillance cameras buying items such as bras, tank tops, and sunglasses that total over $400. And she pays for these items from the checks that she stole from Amy. And once again, Kaylee is not seen at the store with Casey on any of this surveillance footage. Kaylee has not been seen by anyone or any surveillance footage at all since June 16th.
Why is she stealing from her friends? Like, I don't know. It just paints like a bigger picture that she's just not like, obviously not a trustworthy person. Like, why would she steal from her? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, she's obviously trying to show somebody that maybe she has a job and she has money. Like, is she still trying to play that off? So that's how she shows them, like, oh, I can buy stuff, but she's really just stealing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's actually a good point, too. I never thought of that. Like, everyone, she has a job. So if she didn't have money to pay for things, people might think, like, where's all your money going? So I guess she had to keep that illusion up. But also, she stole her mother's credit card, too, at one point, and was making purchases with it. So, you know, I'm sure she got questioned by Cindy herself, but just like she's obviously not a trustworthy person. She's stealing from all her friends and all this stuff. So it's just whack. So Casey has a boyfriend around the time that Kaylee goes missing, and a series of her boyfriend's former roommates were interviewed for the Where the Truth Lies documentary that I watched. And they indicate in their interviews that before June of 2008, Casey would bring Kaylee over to Tony's place many times, and she seemed to be a great mother from what they observed. They saw her always getting Kaylee's things ready for school. She would do flashcards with her to help her learn words and things like that. So during June and July of 2008, they saw nothing at all to indicate that anything was wrong. Casey seemed happy, and she was kind of living her best life, or I guess the good life, as she would probably say. So when they found out in mid-July that Kaylee had been missing for a month, they were completely shocked. Just didn't line up or make sense to them, because how could her child be missing and yet they see Casey pretty frequently in that time frame, and she's showing that nothing is wrong. You know, she's partying, she's happy, she's acting normal. So for Casey to say that she had spent the 31 days in a frantic independent search for her child, it's just not at all true from the perspectives of her boyfriend's roommates, who can attest for the fact that she didn't lift a finger in those 31 days to do anything to attempt to find her daughter, who they didn't even know was missing or have any reason to think was wrong, anything was wrong. So one of their friends in particular gets pretty emotional and passionate in this documentary, and he's like very angry at Casey because for her to say that she, you know, was acting as everything was normal, like she was acting as everything was normal and they had no reason. So when they see on the news, like they hear on the news that she's missing, that Kaylee is missing, and they didn't hear from Casey even though they're seeing her almost every day. So just super weird and super unforgivable in their eyes.
Also, we know that the grandmother is, you know, she's saying, oh, Kaylee's missing, but she's just saying that as kind of, oh, I haven't seen her, like I'm missing her kind of thing. But Kaylee lived with her, right? So I think that she'd be much more suspicious to be like, she hasn't seen her in 2 weeks at all. Like she hasn't come home at all. She hasn't slept there in 2 weeks at all. Like you'd think that, I don't know, she'd just be a little bit more worried or scared. Like I don't want to judge her about it, but it, to me, you think it would just raise way more red flags than it did.
That's what I was going to say. Like, I was, you have to realize, like, Casey and Kaylee both lived there. So for her not to see her every day or not to see her for 2 weeks straight, you think she'd be more worried about where she is.
But I think, I mean, she was concerned, but I think, like Cindy has said, that she thought that Casey was purposely keeping Kaylee from her. Like, in terms of, because she and her mother had a very rocky relationship. So she thought it was Casey's way of getting back at her, that she was not going to let her see Kaylee. So she's like questioning it, but she doesn't necessarily know that she's actually missing and isn't with Casey. She just thinks that Casey's being, you know, vindictive and keeping her from her. So that's not really something that you can call 911 about necessarily, because like, I don't really know what the laws are regarding like grandparents' rights to see the kids. But like, if they think that she's with her daughter, like if Casey and Kaylee are together and she just thinks that Casey's being a brat, like that's nothing that you're not going to call 911 over that necessarily.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense when you put it like that, because I guess Casey probably wasn't like spending the night every night at her parents' house, right? She was probably out with her boyfriend and at friend's house. And so her mom, yeah, probably just thought that she took Kaylee with her all those times. That's why she wasn't home sleeping every night. So yeah.
Yeah. And I think in that MySpace post that Cindy made, like that's, she's kind of relaying that sort of feeling of Kaylee is missing, but she said it was a term of like, she just thought Casey was keeping her from them. And so that was her plea online, I guess, for her to see Kaylee. But yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, yeah, when you put it like that, like it makes sense that that was just her thinking. You're not going to jump to necessarily that, because she says that from everything that she saw, Casey was a great mother. Like she was very attentive. She was very caring and loving to Kaylee. So the fact that she might do something to harm Kaylee never crossed Cindy or George's mind. So they just think she's being vindictive.
It's funny to me that like Cindy was the only, like Cindy was not, well, I shouldn't say the only one, but like the one that seemed more concerned or more upset about not seeing Kaylee. Like George never really seemed that upset of not seeing Kaylee. Like he didn't, like there was no like him showing like emotion about him not seeing Kaylee all the time. So that to me is kind of weird too.
Well, I think he did.
Well,
yeah.
He might have been upset But he probably wasn't posting it on, like, MySpace. That wasn't, like, his outlet. He might have just been saying it, like, privately to Cindy herself, right? And not, obviously, there's no media attention at that time. So he wasn't saying it to anybody, but probably just himself and his family. So, yeah. And also, yeah, I think it's a good point because we are looking in at this from knowing what had happened. So, yeah, when you're in it, and since Casey did seem like a good mom, I guess it is a good point that you wouldn't just automatically think that she had done something to her because you don't see her. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, like, I feel like Cindy probably in many ways kind of is, like, the spokesperson for the two of them. So, like, she will kind of say what her and George are both thinking. And George probably isn't on Facebook or MySpace talking about it. So, like Katie said. So, you're hearing it from Cindy and she might be more vocal, but that doesn't mean that George wasn't also concerned. We just don't necessarily know the specific details because he didn't post about it online. So the investigation into the Anthony family's computer and online activity led investigators to some disturbing information. So in March of 2008, which would have been just a couple of months before Kaylee is last seen, online search history shows a search for chloroform 84 times on the family computer. Additional searches for things like neck breaking and household weapons were also discovered on the computer, which is obviously very troubling and suspicious. So the search for chloroform and the mystery surrounding it is really something that would come up during the trial that we're going to go into in the next part of this case in the next episode, but it would prove to be very important to the outcome of this case ultimately. So it was later reported after the trial that due to a software error during the search of the computer, the fact that chloroform was searched for 84 times was actually not accurate. And there had actually, in fact, only been one search for that term. But in my opinion, one time is still too many. So whether it was one or 84, I mean, who's looking up chloroform on their computer? Sketchy, to say the least, I would say. So that obviously that wasn't in the 31-day timeline that happened in March, those searches, but just something to be kind of aware of as we move forward in the case here. So I kind of reviewed the main pieces. Obviously, there's, you know, documents and articles that go into every little detail, like every text that she sent in those 31 days, every cell phone ping, like where she was. Obviously, I'm not going to get into the weeds with all of that information. I just kind of covered the main points that I thought were relevant to the conversation. So, yeah, I mean, you guys have already kind of given your opinions on some of those pieces. But I just wanted to go back to, like, the part where she talks about she thinks that there is, like, a dead animal on the frame of her car. That kind of stuck out to me when I was looking at it. That was a text that she sent to her friend saying that there's definitely a dead animal on the frame of her car. And that was actually, she sent that text the day that she left the vehicle in the Amscot parking lot. So what do you guys think of that? Do you think that this was maybe a deliberate thing by Casey to maybe, if she's thinking that there's going to be a smell of Kaylee, maybe trying to have like text evidence to for a possible explanation, or do you think she wasn't really thinking that far ahead and that is something that actually did happen?
I don't really know. I mean, it kind of sounds like something that she would do, but then again, like, it, like, who, like, I don't know, like, yeah, I really don't know.
So yeah, I don't have an opinion because I know that this comes up in the trial, and the prosecution actually uses it as some of their basis for their charge of premeditated first degree murder. So they do see it as this is something that Casey's trying to plant ahead of time because she knows that there's going to be a smell.
Yeah. And obviously a timeline, just like in every case that we talk about, as particularly this one, is important because, as we'll talk about later, like June 16th is a really important date in this timeline. And we know, and also the shovel part, I also wanted to talk about the shovel part. So there is, you know, it's been corroborated and confirmed that Casey did go to her neighbor's house on June 18th to ask to borrow a shovel to, you know, dig up some bamboo root in her. Yeah. Okay, fine. So June 18th, so that would be 2 days after Kaylee was last seen. And we'll get into it in the trial of kind of when people believe that Kaylee was actually murdered or when she died. So June 18th would fall after that time. So what do you guys think of this? Just a random coincidence, or do you think there's something more to it?
Yeah, so that doesn't come up like a ton in what I was looking at. So I don't know if they just overlooked it or if they just didn't think it was significant. I don't know, to me, because I don't want to go too far ahead here because I know how she was found and where she was found and how her body was, and like it wasn't buried. So it, to me, it doesn't seem super relevant. Maybe she thought she was going to bury her if, you know, Casey did dispose of the body. But to me, it doesn't seem super relevant.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was very relevant at all.
Yeah, I think, again, not wanting to go too far ahead, but I think it's used in the prosecution as sort of maybe Casey, after murdering Kaylee, was going to bury Kaylee's body in like the family's backyard, but then decided against it for whatever reason. So then she returned the shovel after she changed her mind. So, I mean, this is, again, a circumstantial thing, but it's like, how many pieces of circumstantial things need to happen for you to like believe that there was foul play? Because like, of course, 1, 2, 3 things could be circumstantial. But then when there's like this much stuff that just happens, like, what are the chances that all of these things are just circumstantial and coincidental? I don't really believe that that many things could happen that would be coincidental, unless there was some other explanation. But that's just me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree. Like, where's the line of, oh, there's 3 circumstantial things. That's not enough, but 4 is enough. Or maybe it just depends on the quality of the circumstances. But yeah, it's especially something like in this case where the circumstantial evidence is super important. Yeah, it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, so that's just one thing. And that's why I included it in the timeline, because I thought it kind of stood out to me as weird. I mean, there's no other evidence that Casey was ever super into doing yard work or why. It's just a random detail, but one that I wanted to include. So, yeah, that's, like I said, that's the 31-day timeline of the most important pieces that I kind of picked out from it that I thought were relevant to what we're going to be talking about during these 4 episodes. But now to kind of shift gears away from that timeline and a little bit more into Casey herself. She is interviewed, like I said, in the documentary Where the Truth Lies, which I regrettably watched. And she admits to all the lying that she had done up to this point. And she fully owns up to the fact that a lot of the stuff that she was doing or saying in this month of June and July was her lying and manipulating everyone in her life. Because she goes on to explain that she grew up around that type of behavior, and she learned it from her father, George. She says that he had a series of indiscretions while she was growing up, things like infidelity, and that he cheated on Cindy multiple times. And she also goes into some really dark details, just like, be warned about some of this graphic information about sexual assault, which I'm going to go into. Not too much of the information, but just to kind of give you an idea of her defense or her claims. So she claims that her father raped her repeatedly when she was a child, and that she also had her brother sent in to do inappropriate things with her as well when she was young. And so as a result of this, Casey says that she had suffered severe trauma and PTSD, and she kind of equates these situations and lying to the police and everyone in her life, because she really was just out of fear of these things in her past coming out, and that she had just had this trauma buried so deep down inside, and she had this hatred for her father and just all of this sort of stuff. So she was doing a lot of things and grew up around that type of behavior where lying and manipulation was a constant. So she just kind of did it to get by in many ways, is what she's saying. So she claims, she also claims that she was raped at a house party when she was 18 years old, and that the person who raped her is actually Kaylee's father. And she told a new boyfriend that she had around that time, his name was Jesse Grund, she told him that he was Kaylee's father and let him believe that during her entire pregnancy. He eventually took a paternity test and actually found out the truth that he wasn't Kaylee's father. And this was after he had been in Kaylee's life for, you know, almost 2 years, and he was her father figure. So once he found that out, he kind of just left. And that was kind of a blow to Casey. And Casey's friends and family never actually knew who Kaylee's father really was. And they believed that it was a man that Casey told them had died in a car accident. So she said it was, quote, a random one-night thing, end quote, and that she was not in a relationship with this man before he died. And they actually play a piece of news footage from 2008 of Cindy Anthony. And apparently she believes this lie about this man who died in a car accident being Kaylee's father, because she's heard in a news interview from 2008 talking about Kaylee's father having died. So obviously she believed that, or she's telling the media that at least. So Casey's family and her friends all believed that Kaylee's father was a man that Casey had had a one-night stand with, who then died shortly after in a car accident, and that they knew that Jesse Grund wasn't the father. So those are the two people that were like kind of in contention for being Kaylee's father, but they believed it was this man who died. But Casey claims that the real father is the man who raped her, whose identity remains unknown to this day. So this is something that her family never knew. No one ever knew. So it's kind of new pieces of information. From a physiological or psychological perspective, Casey experienced severe shame and guilt from what happened to her at that house party when she was 18. And her father and brothers alleged assaults on her from childhood. But almost everything in her life when Kaylee was alive was kind of a lie out of fear of these things getting found out, or just that's how her trauma sort of manifested itself. It's like kind of thriving off this life of lies and manipulation and that sort of thing. So I guess that she's saying that she kind of just became accustomed to lying and therefore just began to lie uncontrollably to everyone around her, especially about the circumstances of Kaylee's disappearance. So that's kind of an interesting take, or interesting to hear from Casey, I guess. And, you know, whether you believe her or not is sort of irrelevant, but that's what she's saying happened, and she's kind of explaining herself in that way. But she does say that in every lie that she told, there was a seed of truth somewhere in there. She says that she did know someone named Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez, that she called Zanny, and that this person was actually a nanny, but was never actually her nanny. And like I said, the apartment complex that she claims Zanny lived at was the same complex that a high school friend of hers named Annie Downing Goderwiz lived. So she said that she also did apparently work at Universal Studios in the past, just not when she said she did. And this is probably just so that she could recall specific details about these things if asked to. So she could talk about working at Universal because she had worked there. She could take detectives right into the office buildings because she'd been there. So it was probably easier for her to kind of make lies out of this because she had some of knowledge that would be easier to lie about. And it's probably the same for Zanny's place of residence. Like, she had been there several times visiting her friend Annie. So she would know the route to that apartment. She would know that apartment complex. So if she was ever asked to go there by police or something, she would be able to. But like we mentioned before in the previous episode, like, shouldn't really have a plan beyond that. Like, yes, she could take them to that apartment complex, or yes, she could take them to Universal Studios, but just didn't have a plan for when she actually got there, what the next step was. So that's where her story all fell apart. So she was smart in some ways, I guess, in that regard, because she was able to build on real life experiences and make lies out of them, but she didn't really have a plan beyond that.
Yeah, to me, it makes me think, because like, she wasn't banking on the fact that they would go any further. Like, she could just say, yes, I work at Universal Studios, and they would take that just as the truth because she told them. So I think maybe she's just so used to lying and people believing her and her getting away with it that she really didn't think that she had to think beyond that. So that kind of just goes into like her kind of her mental state where she lies so much and everyone believes it that she thought that she could continue to do so.
Yeah. And like her lies had never gotten out of control like this before. So she had no reason to think it would this time, I guess. It's just interesting when you hear her talking about it and about how she would plant these little lies based on real experiences. But yeah, it's just an interesting kind of take on it. Now going forward a little bit. So now we're in October of 2008. And on October 14th, Casey was indicted by a grand jury and officially charged with murder in Kaylee's death. But up to that point, there wasn't even a body that had been found, and Casey would, of course, plead not guilty to the charges and would continue to. So to be charged in the murder of Kaylee without a body and any evidence that she was even dead was a shocking move. Like, remember, in October, they didn't even have a body. They don't know she's dead. She's still a missing person. So to her to be charged with murder when they don't have a body, they don't have a method of death or a cause of death or anything like that. But however, sadly, on December 11th, this would change, because this was the day that skeletal remains were found in a wooded area less than a mile from the Anthony home by a meter reader named Roy Kronk. So eventually it's determined that the skeletal remains were those of Kaylee Marie Anthony. This confirms everyone's worst fears that Kaylee was dead, and many fingers were pointing to Casey being responsible at this time. And I guess even before that, but especially now that they have found her remains. As it turns out, Roy Kronk actually stumbled upon what he says were these same remains 4 months earlier, on August 11th, 2008, and he called 911 to report it. So although he didn't see the full remains at this time, he just saw something suspicious from a distance, and he mentions that he saw something that he was, quote, 99.99% sure was a human skull, end quote. He claims later that he was with two other colleagues at this time, and they kind of went to approach what they found, but then they actually came across a large dead rattlesnake in the woods, which frightened them, and this kind of shifted their attention instead of poking around the suspicious thing that they had just discovered. So Roy Kronk also calls 911 the following day on August 12th and meets a deputy at the scene. And the deputy reportedly, quote, looked one way and then the other and then berated me for half an hour for wasting his time, end quote. So it's weird that after calling it in more than once about finding something suspicious, nothing really happened. And then he just sort of left it alone. So that's super weird. And then it's months later on December 11th, like I said, he returns to the same location to call it in again when he actually sees the human skull on the ground. And this would be a major point of contention, and it's something that the defense would try to exploit and try to use to their advantage during the trial. So I'm actually going to play part of the original 911 call from Roy Kronk on August 11th. So you'll hear him talking about finding what he thinks are the remains. He even mentions Kaylee's name, because at this point in August, it's all over the news. It's a huge story. So I'm going to play a little bit of that call for you.
911, what's your emergency?
Hi, I don't have it. I called the non-emergency line.
How can I help you, sir?
I'm a meter reader with Orange County, and I had the route today that included the Anthony's home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I went down to the school and came back, and when I was coming back, I stopped between the two swamp areas there. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about or not.
No, but go ahead.
But there's a stretch of road there that goes from like the, where the start of their road is down to a school, and in between it on either side, there's a swamp. And if you're heading back out towards the main road on the left-hand side in an area, I noticed something that looked white, and there was, I don't know what it is. I'm not telling you it's, you know, it's Kaylee or anything of that nature.
Okay.
But yeah. I just thought,
do you know what street Anthony Home is on?
Yeah, it's on Good Hope, isn't it?
Okay, Good Homes, and what's the nearest intersecting street?
It's the one it comes off of, isn't that? It's like Suburban or something like that?
Hold on, I just want to bring up the map. Hold on.
Because I just read that. That's the route I have today to read the meters on.
Hold on.
It's like, the school's 8701 Suburban Drive, but it's actually at the end of the road, not at the beginning of the road. And that's where the, and their road comes off of Suburban Drive. And I work up at the Curry Ford, you know, at the headquarters there, Curry Ford. And we were over there reading that today. And,
okay, I have the map now, okay?
Yeah.
8701 Suburban is in Chickasaw Oaks Subdivision.
Yeah, that's
the nearest intersecting street is Chickasaw and Lumberton.
Right. If you go down that road, that's where the school's at. In between from where you can get onto their road at and down, there's a swamp area. If you're heading towards the school on the right and left, if you're heading towards the school, it would be on your right-hand side. And there's like a big swamp area there, and there we found a dead 4-foot Eastern Diamond Rattle back there, but that's not really the thing. There's like two little in areas you can go, and there's a big long tree laying down, and there's a lot of swamp back in there. Well, back behind one of the trees down there was a great, all that 4-foot Eastern Diamond Rattlesnake. I'm not going in that crap.
Okay, so if you're going on Suburban,
you're heading down towards the school.
Okay, and it's after Chickasaw on the right hand side.
Yeah, there's the road kind of stops, and then there's like this, you go down, and there's a 6-foot tall fence on the left-hand side, and then the right-hand side open heading towards the school, and it's all swamp area on both sides. And it would be on the right-hand side that I saw what I saw.
Okay, I'll let him know.
I appreciate you, and once again, I have no idea what it was, so and I don't want to waste any more of the county's money, but I'm just telling you I saw something.
Not a problem.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And then now I'm going to play the 911 call that was made on December 11th. And this is right after Roy Kronk finds the remains and the skull in the woods, allegedly for the second time. So you're going to hear someone, it's not Roy himself, but it's someone else calling it in that one of his employees has found the remains in the woods. So I'll play that for you.
Yes, this is Orange County Utilities Emergency Dispatch. We found a human skull.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. We got a, is it a meter reader?
Yes.
I'm going to just speak right now with the representative from our field services facilities. Hi. I'm going to, everything is recorded. Here he is.
How are you doing? Skull of a, if you believe it's human.
What's the location, please?
It's right off of Suburban and Chickasaw in the Kelly Anthony area, right by the
school. Do you have a specific address for me or not?
No, it's right by the school. If you take
Michigan,
it easy.
You are.
Yeah,
Suburban and Golden Month?
Well, Suburban and Chickasaw.
Chickasaw, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the school is right there. I can't think of the name of the school. It just go right straight down. It dead ends right into the woods.
Okay.
It'll be on the east side of Chickasaw, Suburban.
East side of Chickasaw. And what is your party's name that we're going to meet with? He's not touching this, I hope.
Okay. No,
he's a
meter reader.
Meter reader?
Yeah, and I'll just tell him to stay at that location and just stay away from everything.
Okay. And if you can, try to stress to him to please not draw attention to the area.
Okay.
And that would be great, just in case it is something. It may be nothing, but just in
True.
Case.
Yes.
And you're from what department?
Utilities Customer Service.
Utilities.
And if you need any information, my phone number is...
Go ahead and send a call up for a deputy to meet with him.
Okay.
And we'll see you there very shortly. What type of vehicle is he going to be in?
Probably a Colorado. Small Colorado white.
It'll have
Orange County. It'll have Orange County insignia on it.
Okay. White Colorado
Chevy
truck.
Colorado. Yes.
And with Orange County markings.
Yes.
Orange County markings. Okay. We'll see you there very shortly, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So do you guys have any thoughts about Roy Kronk in general or about how he did find these remains apparently in August, but then nothing happened?
Yeah, so I was going to bring this up a bit later because they say the defense kind of like tears him down saying, well, why'd you wait so long to call in again? And he does have like a defense for that, but I'm thinking like it's not his job to find something and then investigate it and figure out what it is and then keep calling. I would think that if you call and then police are supposed to come and if they kind of determine that it isn't anything, well, then why is it your responsibility to kind of keep following up on that? And especially since he didn't know for sure that it was a body, right? Like, he just saw this bag and this debris where people throw garbage anyway. So, I mean, in his defense, it's not his job to constantly go back and be like, come back, and then call again, come back, right? So that's kind of what my opinion is on that, too.
Yeah, I'm just shocked that when he did call for the first time, or the second time, I can't remember which one, that the police just went there and just, like, didn't really look around. You think, like, if someone said they think they saw some human remain, you would do a more thorough check. Not just, like, look one way and look the other. So, like, and yeah, like, you're right, like, it's not his job to investigate further. That's what the police are there for, to investigate those type of things. And the fact that they didn't really do that the first time kind of shows you that, like...
Yeah, and he also gets some flack for, like, trying to kind of poke around further when he comes out that he lifts up the bag and, like, kind of pokes at it and stuff. Like, well, why'd you do that? It's like, well, you know, if he didn't, he'd be like, well, why didn't you? And then he does. And it's like, well, why'd you touch it? So, he can't win either way. So I feel like, you know, he did more than most people maybe would have. Maybe not most, but he did more than what, you know, other people might have done.
Yeah, like he really did do his due diligence. Like he called more than once, right? He called on the 11th when he first found. At that time, like he said, it looked like what he thought was a skull, but I think it was sort of questioned about what it really was. It was more like it was like a bag. He had seen the bag, maybe something sticking out of it. But like I said, got distracted by the rattlesnake. He was with other people and called it in. Then the next day called it in again. So definitely did more than he even had to. Who knows who might have. Someone might not have even called it in at all, and he did it twice. So it's kind of on the sheriff or the police department, in my opinion, who didn't follow up on it. But it's just sad that, like, they didn't follow up on it in August, because as we'll get into when we talk more about the body and the remains, like, if the body had been found in August and some of the forensic analysis had been done then, there might be way more to go on, and we might be in a much better place for a prosecution than what we got, because by the time December happens... It's, you know, 6 months after she went missing, 6 months after she was killed, and there's so much decomposition that really a lot of forensic evidence is lost. So I'm going to go into a little bit more of that, but it just sucks that this was really a missed opportunity in August where things could have been handled much, much differently. A People's Magazine article from June 2011, so this would have been released around the time of the trial that happened in 2011, it explains that Roy Kronk actually changes his story during the trial from that of an original deposition that he gave about the events that happened when he discovered the body. So at trial, he claims that he used a stick to poke at the skull, but that he never actually touched it. In his previous deposition, he claims that he did touch the bag that the skull was in and lifted it 4 feet off the ground, and then that caused the skull to fall out of the bag. So that's also something the defense is going to use against him and use against the prosecution of, like, why did he change his story? Did he touch it? Did he not touch it? And then he kind of says, like, he doesn't really remember what happened. So maybe he had different memories at those two different times. But I just remember, like, when this was happening, that there was so much energy focused on this man, Roy Kronk, of, like, did he move the body? People think that he was, like, tipped off to where the body was and that he went and removed it, moved it somewhere else, and then so he could claim the reward that they had. Because obviously they had a reward if anyone found anything regarding Kaylee's disappearance. So there was all these conspiracy theories. People think that he was in on it with Casey or in on it with the Anthonys or something. Just a lot of conspiracy theories, but I personally don't think he had anything to do with it. Just a man who was a meter reader trying to do the right thing multiple times, and it's kind of the police who dropped the ball in August. So those are my thoughts, but what do you guys think? Like, maybe you'll go into this more, Katie, in like the trial and stuff, but there was a lot of emphasis on this man, Roy Kronk, and like, could he have been involved? And I just think a lot of that is BS.
Yeah, I agree. I don't believe any of it. I think he was just happened to find something and called it in. I don't think he had anything to do with the case. I think he just stumbled upon it and did the best he thought he could with by calling it in. And yeah, I don't think focusing on him is what they needed to do.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of do touch on this a little bit in the next episode when we talk about the trial and what came out. And the defense does try to tear him down and discredit him and, yeah, say that he moved the body and the remains and everything. So, but yeah, in my opinion, I feel like he didn't have anything to do with it. He was just trying to be a good Samaritan and report what he had found.
I guess when you're a defense attorney, that is your job to literally look at every detail and blow certain things up out of proportion, because all you have to do is really put doubt into the juror's mind. In the jury's mind, you don't have to have a super convincing argument. You just have to put that little bit of doubt in there. So that is one thing they went with, was trying to question this man's legitimacy or question what he had to do with it, which is, like I said, just BS, I feel. But when Kaylee's body was found just a few miles from the Anthony home, there was duct tape wrapped around her skull, and she was wrapped in a blanket found inside a laundry bag. And there was no cause of death at that time. And when DNA came back, Casey's DNA was not found on the duct tape. There was no evidence that linked Casey to this case or to this body. However, the laundry bag that was found with Kaylee's remains was identical to another laundry bag that was found in the Anthony home. So apparently the two bags were part of a set that the family had, and one was in the Anthony home. The other one was found with Kaylee's body. So again, that's not a circumstantial thing. Like, how common was this laundry bag? Was this something that anyone could have had? Just another thing to keep in mind. That's kind of sketchy. And then according to a CNN report from around the time of Kaylee's body's discovery, quote, there was no trauma visible on the completely skeletonized remains of slain toddler Kaylee Anthony, but there were overlapping pieces of duct tape over her mouth, according to the autopsy report released Friday, end quote. So the tape was still attached to part of the skull's head hair, and chief medical examiner Dr. Jan Garavaglia says, quote, this duct tape was clearly placed prior to decomposition, keeping the mandible in place, end quote. This medical examiner said animals had also scattered the bones after decomposition began. So basically, like, the remains were a mess, like the bones were scattered everywhere. The skull was the biggest piece that was found. There was duct tape found on the skull, but because it had been so long and it was outside, the terrain and the just exposure to the elements really impacted the amount of forensic evidence that could be gathered from the body. So like I said, by the time the remains were found, nearly 6 months had passed since Kaylee was last seen. And this heavily wooded area where the body was found had also been severely flooded during the summer of 08. And while no longer flooded by December, the conditions of the terrain due to the flooding made the recovery of the remains much more difficult. It was very muddy and not very conducive to finding tiny bone fragments of a child's remains. So like the medical examiner had said, animals scattered the bones as well. So there were just lots of pieces missing, and the body was severely decomposed, which would make determining a cause of death much more difficult in this case. So her cause of death was officially listed as homicide by undetermined means, because the body had been so decomposed that they couldn't even run toxicology reports. Obviously, you know, there's no skin left on the bones. So if, you know, they could find things like ligature marks on skin, if they had found the body, you know, ligature marks that might say she was strangled or something, but when you have only the skull, only the fragments, it's very hard to come to any sort of logical conclusion that you could if you had found a full body. So very, very unclear what happened. But so due to this, the skull was the most important piece of this discovery because of the duct tape that was across the mouth. And this was really the only major piece of evidence that could provide insight into how 2-year-old Kaylee died. And the prosecution would go on to argue at trial that Kaylee was killed by being given too much chloroform, possibly to sedate her, and then was suffocated with the duct tape that was put across her mouth. So that's kind of where the prosecution's coming from. What are you guys' thoughts on, like, the discovery of the body and kind of all of that stuff I just reviewed?
Well, where the body was located was very far from their house. So that's suspicious in itself. But the fact that there was no DNA, per se, on the duct tape, it's so hard to know, like, what actually... Like, we know she died, but, like, how she died, it's kind of hard to know that. And the fact that who was involved in her death, because there's no really DNA that they found. So, like, it's really tough to know, and it's sad that that's how she, like, how she was found. And for such a little girl, like, it's just sad, just so sad that she even died in the first place.
Yeah, and this is, that was one of the biggest things that hurt the prosecution, was the fact that they could not say how she died. And so the defense was like, well, how can you say she was murdered if you can't even say how she died? Which is, you know, that's a good point. But also, why would you have duct tape around your mouth if it was anything other than a homicide? Which is also a good point. But they can't prove either way. And so I'm going to get into a lot more of the evidence and kind of what both sides, the prosecution and the defense, had to say about it. So that's going to be super interesting. It's kind of like my favorite part of cases, is kind of going back and forth, both sides, what happened and the opinions on both sides. So that's going to be super interesting. And so don't forget to come back and listen to part 3. Yeah, so I mean, at this stage of the, like, investigation and what we have so far, it kind of seems like it's so obvious that it was a murder and that it was Casey. But I'm going to kind of poke hole. I'm not saying that I think she's innocent, but I'm going to present some of the facts that the defense did to kind of poke holes in the prosecution. And you can see why maybe the jury decided what they did at the end of the trial.
Yeah, also I always wanted to know, which I didn't see in my research, or maybe there's a lot of information, so maybe I missed it, but like, wouldn't there have been a search of some sort, like, in the area surrounding the home? Like, at this time, Casey's in jail. In October, she was charged with murder. So wouldn't there be, like, a cursory search of, like, maybe the wooded area near the house? Like, to me, it just is weird that, like, maybe this wasn't searched in depth. Because obviously, if they did a little bit of a search, they might have found the remains much earlier. But I guess maybe part of that is, like, if you can poke holes in the story, it's, like, to bolster, like, was the body moved later? Because it's, like, well, maybe they did do a search and they didn't find it. And then it was later, in August or December, when they actually were found. So
that does come up. I do go into some of that. A lot of it was like, there was water there when they were trying to do a lot of the searches. They think that the body was dumped into water, actually. So when they were trying to do a lot of the searching, they couldn't because of where the body was and there was water there. But they do bring up the fact that, well, she was so close to home. And they scrutinize kind of the investigators for not finding her sooner because she was so close. So they're saying it was kind of a shoddy job. So yeah, we'll touch on some of that in part 3.
And what do you guys think of, like, the, just skipping back a little bit, because we didn't really talk about it when I was covering it, but, like, what do you guys think of what Casey's allegations are, just from this documentary and the stuff I've said so far, like, about when she was growing up and kind of the indiscretions of her father? Like, what do you guys make of that whole thing? And just her constant lying, that she's kind of relating back to that trauma.
I kind of don't believe that. I mean, this is like, I'm this, people might hate me for this, so don't come at me, but like, I don't believe that what she said about her father. Like, I don't believe that. I don't think that's true, because like, she's lied so many times. I mean, maybe I'm totally wrong and it is true, but I just don't think, I think it's just something that, like, she happened just to say, like, bring it up randomly during her interviews and stuff. So I don't fully believe that that's what happened. But like I said, if it did, then that's obviously sad. But I don't think it happened.
I don't know. I can't decide one way or another. I mean, I don't want to believe her, but I also don't want to say it didn't happen because there's no proof either way. So I don't know. I can't have a yes or no opinion on that one because there really isn't enough out there. And like her brother came forward and never agreed or disagreed with it either. So it's hard to say.
And I mean, I have issues, like I said at the beginning of this case, with George. So like, I don't like if he did, then that just made that. Then it just proves my theory of how I feel about him. But if he didn't, he's not a very nice guy anyways. Like, he's lied multiple times too, so it's really hard for me to believe.
But Casey's such a liar, like, it's so hard to believe anything she says. So it's so hard to believe her about this.
And, like, she is why sometimes actual victims of sexual assault get a bad rap or get that question of, like, can you believe it? Because it's people like her who lie so much all the time. And, I mean, I can't, like, again, I'm not her. I don't know if it happened, but it just seems to me like it's when you lie once, your credibility is ruined, I feel, especially when you lie multiple times to the degree that she did. So I can't really definitively obviously say one way or the other. There was also sort of reports that came out that like there was questions of like whether her brother Lee was actually Kaylee's father, which he did do a paternity test and was not Kaylee's father. But that was also something that was thrown up in this. So I feel like either way, it's like despicable. So either you have George, who is disgusting perv, who's like molesting his daughter, or you have Casey, who's willing to completely throw an innocent person under the bus, claiming that they did that when they didn't. So one of those two things is true. And either way, it's horrible.
Yeah. But either way, I want to say whether he did or did not, it doesn't excuse the fact that if Casey murdered her daughter, that, oh, you know, she was traumatized. Like, that's not an excuse. So I feel like it's not completely relevant to Kaylee's murder. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. And I guess we'll probably get into it in the next episode too. Just like the defense's strategy. I mean, they had to villainize George during the trial and question his credibility and question his character, because that plays a big part into what their defense is ultimately going to be about what happened to Kaylee, like the specific details. So it's all part of the defense's strategy, right? If you can paint him as this horrible person, then maybe the defense's theory is a little bit more believable. So that's definitely something that's kind of in line with that as well in this documentary. When Casey's talking about the stuff that happened, it's definitely in line with like maligning George as this horrible person, which again, whether he is or isn't, doesn't necessarily, if Casey killed Kaylee, it doesn't make it acceptable just because she went through that. Two wrongs don't make her right, you know? So either way, like if Casey did it, it's horrible, but I don't know. It's just, you'll see like in the defense's strategy, like in part three for the trial, like villainizing George was very much a part of their approach. Just put it that way. So what are you guys, I've just put this out to the audience listening. So what are you guys' thoughts on this case so far? Like everything we've covered, do you believe Casey? Do you not believe Casey about her allegations about her father? What do you think of George and Cindy and the family in general? What do you think of Roy Kronk, this man who found the body? What do you think of the timeline, some of the important pieces and the tattoo and all of that stuff? Because we covered a lot in this episode, so want to make sure you get your opinions in. You can, you know, submit them. You can email us. You can message us on our website. You can, you know, all of our episodes are up onto YouTube. So if you're watching this on YouTube, please comment under this video what you think, what your thoughts are, because we want to hear them. Also, you can follow us on all the social medias, at Instagram and Facebook at Crime Family Podcast. We're also on Twitter, or X, I guess now, Crime Family Pod 1. And you can join us on Patreon if you want to support the show and get some bonus content. There's a link to that in the show notes. And also our merch. You can check out our merch store and buy some official Crime Family swag. The link to that is in the show notes as well. And yeah, interact with us as many ways as you can. Let us know what you think of the show and about these episodes in this case, because we want to hear all of it. So we'll be back next week with part three of the Kaylee Anthony murder trial and case, and also the trial of Casey Anthony. So make sure you tune in next week, because we're going to go even further into the trial and all of those kind of nitty-gritty details of what happened during the trial. So thanks so much. And until then, take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.